witnessed by a crowd of strangers from Italy and the West, who related with grief and indignation the sacrilege of the emperor. But on the reception of his prescriptive edict, they trembled for their domestic deities. The images of Christ and the Virgin, of the angels, martyrs, and saints, were abolished in all the churches of Italy, and a strong alternative was proposed to the Roman pontiff, the royal favor as the price of his compliance, degradation and exile as the penalty of his disobedience. Neither zeal nor policy allowed him to hesitate, and the haughty strain in which Gregory addressed the emperor displays his confidence in the truth of his doctrine or the powers of resistance. Without depending on prayers or miracles, he boldly armed against the public enemy, and his pastoral letters admonished the Italians of their danger and their duty. At this signal, Ravenna, Venice, and the cities of the Exarchate and Pentapolis adhered to the cause of religion. Their military force by sea and land consisted, for the most part, of the natives, and the spirit of patriotism and zeal was transfused into the mercenary strangers. The Italians swore to live and die in the defense of the Pope and the holy images. The Roman people was devoted to their father, and even the Lombards were ambitious to share the merit and advantage of this holy war. The most treasonable act, but the most obvious revenge, was the destruction of the statues of Leo himself. The most effectual and pleasing measure of rebellion was the withholding the tribute of Italy and depriving him of a power which he had recently abused by the imposition of a new capitation. A form of administration was preserved by the election of magistrates and governors, and so high was the public indignation that the Italians were prepared to create an orthodox emperor and to conduct him with a fleet and army to the palace of Constantinople. In that palace, the Roman bishops, the second and third Gregory, were condemned as the authors of the revolt, and every attempt was made, either by fraud or force, to seize their persons and to strike at their lives. The city was repeatedly visited or assaulted by captains of the guards, and dukes and exarchs of high dignity or secret trust. They landed with foreign troops. They obtained some domestic aid, and the superstition of Naples may blush that her fathers were attached to the cause of heresy. But these clandestine or open attacks were repelled by the courage and vigilance of the Romans. The Greeks were overthrown and massacred. Their leaders suffered an ignominious death, and the popes, however inclined to mercy, refused to intercede for these guilty victims. At Ravenna, the several quarters of the city had long exercised a bloody and hereditary feud. In religious controversy, they found a new ailment of faction. But the votaries of images were superior in numbers or spirit, and the exarch, who attempted to stem the torrent, lost his life in a popular sedition. To punish this flagitious deed and restore his dominion in Italy, the emperor sent a fleet and army into the Adriatic Gulf. After suffering from the winds and waves much loss and delay, the Greeks made their descent in the neighborhood of Ravenna. They threatened to depopulate the guilty capital and to imitate, perhaps to surpass, the example of Justinian II, who had chastised a former rebellion by the choice and execution of 50 of the principal inhabitants. The women and clergy, in sackcloth and ashes, lay prostrate in prayer. The men were in arms for the defense of their country. The common danger had united the factions, and the event of a battle was preferred to the slow miseries of a siege. In a hard-fought day, as the two armies alternately yielded and advanced, a phantom was seen, a voice was heard, and Ravenna was victorious by the assurance of victory. The strangers retreated to their ships, but the populous seacoast poured forth a multitude of boats. The waters of the Po were so deeply infected with blood that during 6 years the public prejudice abstained from the fish of the river. Then the institution of an annual feast perpetuated the worship of images and the abhorrence of the Greek tyrant. Amidst the triumph of the Catholic arms, the Roman pontiff convened a synod of 93 bishops against the heresy of the iconoclasts. With their consent, he pronounced a general excommunication against all who by word or deed should attack the tradition of the fathers and the images of the saints. In this sentence, the emperor was tacitly involved. But the vote of a last and hopeless remonstrance may seem to imply that the anathema was yet suspended over his guilty head. No sooner had they confirmed their own safety, the worship of images, and the freedom of Rome and Italy, than the popes appear to have relaxed of their severity and to have spared the relics of the Byzantine dominion. Their moderate councils delayed and prevented the election of a new emperor, and they exhorted the Italians not to separate from the body of the Roman monarchy. The exarch was permitted to reside within the walls of Ravenna, a captive rather than a master. Until the imperial coronation of Charlemagne, the government of Rome and Italy was exercised in the name of the successors of Constantine. The liberty of Rome, which had been oppressed by the arms and arts of Augustus, was rescued, after 750 years of servitude, from the persecution of Leo the Isaurian. By the Caesars, the triumphs of the consuls had been annihilated. In the decline and fall of the empire, the god Terminus, the sacred boundary, had insensibly receded from the ocean, the Rhine, the Danube, and the Euphrates, and Rome was reduced to her ancient territory from Viterbo to Terracina, and from Narni to the mouth of the Tiber. When the kings were banished, the republic reposed on the firm basis which had been founded by their wisdom and virtue. Their perpetual jurisdiction was divided between two annual magistrates. The Senate continued to exercise the powers of administration and council, and the legislative authority was distributed in the assemblies of the people by a well-proportioned scale of property and service. Ignorant of the arts of luxury, the primitive Romans had improved the science of government and war. The will of the community was absolute. The rights of individuals were sacred. 130,000 citizens were armed for defense or conquest, and a band of robbers and outlaws was molded into a nation deserving of freedom and ambitious of glory. When the sovereignty of the Greek emperors was extinguished, the ruins of Rome presented the sad image of depopulation and decay. Her slavery was a habit, her liberty, an accident, the effect of superstition and the object of her own amazement and terror. The last vestige of the substance or even the forms of the constitution was obliterated from the practice and memory of the Romans, and they were devoid of knowledge or virtue again to build the fabric of a commonwealth. Their scanty remnant, the offspring of slaves and strangers, was despicable in the eyes of the victorious barbarians. As often as the Franks or Lombards expressed their most bitter contempt of a foe, they called him a Roman. And in this name, says the Bishop Liutprand, we include whatever is base, whatever is cowardly, whatever is perfidious, the extremes of avarice and luxury, and every vice that can prostitute the dignity of human nature. By the necessity of their situation, the inhabitants of Rome were cast into the rough model of a republican government. They were compelled to elect some judges in peace and some leaders in war. The nobles assembled to deliberate, and their resolves could not be executed without the union and consent of the multitude. The style of the Roman Senate and people was revived, but the spirit was fled, and their new independence was disgraced by the tumultuous conflict of licentiousness and oppression. The want of laws could only be supplied by the influence of religion, and their foreign and domestic councils were moderated by the authority of the bishop. his alms, his sermons, his correspondence with the kings and prelates of the West, his recent services, their gratitude and oath, accustomed the Romans to consider him as the first magistrate or prince of the city. The Christian humility of the popes was not offended by the name of Dominus, or Lord, and their face and inscription are still apparent on the most ancient coins. Their temporal dominion is now confirmed by the reverence of 1,000 years, and their noblest title is the free choice of a people whom they had redeemed from slavery. In the quarrels of ancient Greece, the holy people of Elis enjoyed a perpetual peace under the protection of Jupiter, and in the exercise of the Olympic Games. Happy would it have been for the Romans if a similar privilege had guarded the patrimony of St. Peter from the calamities of war, if the Christians who visited the holy threshold would have sheathed their swords in the presence of the apostle and his successor. But this mystic circle could have been traced only by the wand of a legislator and a sage. This pacific system was incompatible with the zeal and ambition of the popes. The Romans were not addicted, like the inhabitants of Elis, to the innocent and placid labors of agriculture. And the barbarians of Italy, though softened by the climate, were far below the Grecian states in the institutions of public and private life. A memorable example of repentance and piety was exhibited by Liutprand, king of the Lombards. In arms, at the gate of the Vatican, the conqueror listened to the voice of Gregory II, withdrew his troops, resigned his conquests, respectfully visited the church of St. Peter, and after performing his devotions, offered his sword and dagger, his cuirass and mantle, his silver cross and his crown of gold on the tomb of the apostle. But this religious fervor was the illusion, perhaps the artifice, of the moment. The sense of interest is strong and lasting. The love of arms and rapine was congenial to the Lombards, and both the prince and people were irresistibly tempted by the disorders of Italy, the nakedness of Rome, and the unwarlike profession of her new chief. On the first edicts of the emperor, they declared themselves the champions of the holy images. Liutprand invaded the province of Romagna, which had already assumed that distinctive appellation. The Catholics of the Exarchate yielded without reluctance to his civil and military power, and a foreign enemy was introduced for the first time into the impregnable fortress of Ravenna. That city and fortress were speedily recovered by the active diligence and maritime forces of the Venetians. And those faithful subjects obeyed the exhortation of Gregory himself in separating the personal guilt of Leo from the general cause of the Roman Empire. The Greeks were less mindful of the service than the Lombards of the injury. The two nations, hostile in their faith, were reconciled in a dangerous and unnatural alliance. The king and the exarch marched to the conquest of Spoleto and Rome. The storm evaporated without effect, but the policy of Liutprand alarmed Italy with a vexatious alternative of hostility and truce. His successor, Astolphus, declared himself the equal enemy of the emperor and the pope. Ravenna was subdued by force or treachery, and this final conquest extinguished the series of the exarchs who had reigned with a subordinate power since the time of Justinian and the ruin of the Gothic kingdom. Rome was summoned to acknowledge the victorious Lombard as her lawful sovereign. The annual tribute of a piece of gold was fixed as the ransom of each citizen, and the sword of destruction was unsheathed to exact the penalty of her disobedience. The Romans hesitated. They entreated. They complained. And the threatening barbarians were checked by arms and negotiations till the popes had engaged the friendship of an ally and avenger beyond the Alps. In his distress, the first Gregory had implored the aid of the hero of the age, of Charles Martel, who governed the French monarchy with the humble title of mayor or duke, and who, by his signal victory over the Saracens, had saved his country and perhaps Europe from the Islamic yoke. The ambassadors of the Pope were received by Charles with decent reverence, but the greatness of his occupations and the shortness of his life prevented his interference in the affairs of Italy, except by a friendly and ineffectual mediation. His son Pepin, the heir of his power and virtues, assumed the office of champion of the Roman Church, and the zeal of the French prince appears to have been prompted by the love of glory and religion. But the danger was on the banks of the Tiber, the succor on those of the Seine. And our sympathy is cold to the relation of distant misery. Amidst the tears of the city, Stephen III embraced the generous resolution of visiting in person the courts of Lombardy and France to deprecate the injustice of his enemy or to excite the pity and indignation of his friend. After soothing the public despair by litanies and orations, he undertook this laborious journey with the ambassadors of the French monarch and the Greek emperor. The king of the Lombards was inexorable, but his threats could not silence the complaints, nor retard the speed of the Roman pontiff, who traversed the Pennine Alps, reposed in the abbey of Saint Maurice, and hastened to grasp the right hand of his protector, the hand which was never lifted in vain, either in war or friendship. Stephen was entertained as the visible successor of the apostle. At the next assembly, the field of March or of May, his injuries were exposed to a devout and warlike nation, and he repassed the Alps, not as a suppliant, but as a conqueror, at the head of a French army which was led by the king in person. The Lombards, after a weak resistance, obtained an ignominious peace, and swore to restore the possessions and to respect the sanctity of the Roman Church. But no sooner was Astolphus delivered from the presence of the French arms than he forgot his promise and resented his disgrace. Rome was again encompassed by his arms, and Stephen, apprehensive of fatiguing the zeal of his Transalpine allies, enforced his complaint and request by an eloquent letter in the name and person of St. Peter himself. The apostle assures his adopted sons, the king, the clergy, and the nobles of France, that, dead in the flesh, he is still alive in the spirit, that they now hear and must obey the voice of the founder and guardian of the Roman Church, that the Virgin, the angels, the saints, and the martyrs, and all the host of heaven, unanimously urge the request and will confess the obligation, that riches, victory, and paradise will crown their pious enterprise, and that eternal damnation will be the penalty of their neglect if they suffer his tomb, his temple, and his people to fall into the hands of the perfidious Lombards. The second expedition of Pepin was not less rapid and fortunate than the first. St. Peter was satisfied, Rome was again saved, and Astolphus was taught the lessons of justice and sincerity by the scourge of a foreign master. After this double chastisement, the Lombards languished about 20 years in a state of languor and decay. But their minds were not yet humbled to their condition, and instead of affecting the pacific virtues of the feeble, they peevishly harassed the Romans with a repetition of claims, evasions, and inroads, which they undertook without reflection, and terminated without glory. On either side, their expiring monarchy was pressed by the zeal and prudence of Pope Adrian I, the genius, the fortune, and greatness of Charlemagne, the son of Pepin. These heroes of the church and state were united in public and domestic friendship, and while they trampled on the prostrate, they varnished their proceedings with the fairest colors of equity and moderation. The passes of the Alps and the walls of Pavia were the only defense of the Lombards. The former were surprised, the latter were invested by the son of Pepin, and after a blockade of 2 years, Desiderius, the last of their native princes, surrendered his scepter and his capital. Under the dominion of a foreign king, but in the possession of their national laws, the Lombards became the brethren rather than the subjects of the Franks, who derived their blood and manners and language from the same Germanic origin. The mutual obligations of the popes and the Carlovingian family form the important link of ancient and modern, of civil and ecclesiastical history. In the conquest of Italy, the champions of the Roman Church obtained a favorable occasion, a specious title, the wishes of the people, the prayers and intrigues of the clergy. But the most essential gifts of the popes to the Carlovingian race were the dignities of King of France and of Patrician of Rome. Under the sacerdotal monarchy of St. Peter, the nations began to resume the practice of seeking, on the banks of the Tiber, their kings, their laws, and the oracles of their fate. The Franks were perplexed between the name and substance of their government. All the powers of royalty were exercised by Pepin, mayor of the palace, and nothing except the regal title was wanting to his ambition. His enemies were crushed by his valor. His friends were multiplied by his liberality. His father had been the savior of Christendom, and the claims of personal merit were repeated and ennobled in a descent of four generations. The name and image of royalty was still preserved in the last descendant of Clovis, the feeble Childeric. But his obsolete right could only be used as an instrument of sedition. The nation was desirous of restoring the simplicity of the constitution, and Pepin, a subject and a prince, was ambitious to ascertain his own rank and the fortune of his family. The mayor and the nobles were bound by an oath of fidelity to the royal phantom. The blood of Clovis was pure and sacred in their eyes. And their common ambassadors addressed the Roman pontiff to dispel their scruples or to absolve their promise. The interest of Pope Zachary, the successor of the two Gregories, prompted him to decide and to decide in their favor. He pronounced that the nation might lawfully unite in the same person the title and authority of king, and that the unfortunate Childeric, a victim of the public safety, should be degraded, shaved, and confined in a monastery for the remainder of his days. An answer so agreeable to their wishes was accepted by the Franks as the opinion of a casuist, the sentence of a judge, or the oracle of a prophet. The Merovingian race disappeared from the earth, and Pepin was exalted on a buckler by the suffrage of a free people accustomed to obey his laws and to march under his standard. His coronation was twice performed, with the sanction of the popes, by their most faithful servant, St. Boniface, the Apostle of Germany, and by the grateful hands of Stephen the Third, who in the monastery of St. Denis placed the diadem on the head of his benefactor. The royal unction of the kings of Israel was dexterously applied. The successor of St. Peter assumed the character of a divine ambassador. A German chieftain was transformed into the Lord's anointed. And this Jewish rite has been diffused and maintained by the superstition and vanity of modern Europe. The Franks were absolved from their ancient oath, but a dire anathema was thundered against them and their posterity, if they should dare to renew the same freedom of choice, or to elect a king, except in the holy and meritorious race of the Carlovingian princes. Without apprehending the future danger, these princes gloried in their present security. The secretary of Charlemagne affirms that the French scepter was transferred by the authority of the popes, and in their boldest enterprises they insist, with confidence, on this signal and successful act of temporal jurisdiction. In the change of manners and language, the patricians of Rome were far removed from the Senate of Romulus, on the Palace of Constantine, from the free nobles of the Republic, or the fictitious parents of the Emperor. After the recovery of Italy and Africa by the arms of Justinian, the important and danger of those remote provinces required the presence of a supreme magistrate. He was indifferently styled the exarch, or the patrician. And these governors of Ravenna, who filled their place in the chronology of princes, extended their jurisdiction over the Roman city. Since the revolt of Italy and the loss of the exarchate, the distress of the Romans had exacted some sacrifice of their independence. Yet, even in this act, they exercised the right of disposing of themselves, and the decrees of the Senate and people successively invested Charles Martel and his posterity with the honors of Patrician of Rome. The leaders of a powerful nation would have disdained a servile title and subordinate office, but the reign of the Greek emperors was suspended, and in the vacancy of the empire they derived a more glorious commission from the Pope and the Republic. The Roman ambassadors presented these patricians with the keys of the shrine of St. Peter as a pledge and symbol of sovereignty, with a holy banner which it was their right and duty to unfurl in the defense of the church and city. In the time of Charles Martel and of Pippin, the interposition of the Lombard kingdom covered the freedom while it threatened the safety of Rome, and the patriciate represented only the title, the service, the alliance of these distant protectors. The power and policy of Charlemagne annihilated an enemy and imposed a master. In his first visit to the capital, he was received with all the honors which had formerly been paid to the church, the representative of the emperor. And these honors obtained some new decorations from the joy and gratitude of Pope Adrian I. No sooner was he informed of the sudden approach of the monarch than he dispatched the magistrates and nobles of Rome to meet him with the banner about 30 miles from the city. At the distance of 1 mile, the Flaminian Way was lined with the schools or national communities of Greeks, Lombards, Saxons, etc. The Roman youth were under arms, and the children of a more tender age, with palms and olive branches in their hands, chanted the praises of their great deliverer. At the aspect of the holy crosses and ensigns of the saints, he dismounted from his horse, led the procession of his nobles to the Vatican, and as he ascended the stairs, devoutly kissed each step of the threshold of the apostles. In the portico, Adrian expected him at the head of his clergy. They embraced as friends and equals, but in their march to the altar, the king or patrician assumed the right hand of the pope. Nor was the Frank content with these vain and empty demonstrations of respect. In the 26 years that elapsed between the conquest of Lombardy and his imperial coronation, Rome, which had been delivered by the sword, was subject as his own to the scepter of Charlemagne. The people swore allegiance to his person and family. In his name money was coined, and justice was administered, and the election of the popes was examined and confirmed by his authority. Except an original and self-inherent claim of sovereignty, there was not any prerogative remaining which the title of emperor could add to the patrician of Rome. The gratitude of the Carlovingians was adequate to these obligations, and their names are consecrated as the saviors and benefactors of the Roman Church. Her ancient patrimony of farms and houses was transformed by their bounty into the temporal dominion of cities and provinces, and the donations of the exarchate was the first fruits of the conquests of Pepin. Astolphus, with a sigh, relinquished his prey. The keys and the hostages of the principal cities were delivered to the French ambassador, and in his master's name he presented them before the tomb of St. Peter. The ample measure of the exarchate might comprise all the provinces of Italy which had obeyed the emperor and his vice-regent, but its strict and proper limits were included in the territories of Ravenna, Bologna, and Ferrara. Its inseparable dependency was the Pentapolis, which stretched along the Adriatic from Rimini to Ancona, and advanced into the Midland country as far as the ridges of the Apennine. In this transaction, the ambition and avarice of the popes have been severely condemned. Perhaps the humility of a Christian priest should have rejected an earthly kingdom, which it was not easy for him to govern without renouncing the virtues of his profession. Perhaps a faithful subject, or even a generous enemy, would have been less impatient to divide the spoils of the barbarian. And if the emperor had entrusted Stephen to solicit in his name the restitution of the exarchate, I will not absolve the pope from the reproach of treachery and falsehood. But in the rigid interpretation of the laws, every one may accept, without injury, whatever his benefactor can bestow without injustice. The Greek emperor had abdicated or forfeited his right to the exarchate, and the sword of Astolphus was broken by the stronger sword of the Carlovingian. It was not in the cause of the iconoclast that Pepin has exposed his person and army in a double expedition beyond the Alps. He possessed and might lawfully alienate his conquests, and to the importunities of the Greeks he piously replied that no human consideration should tempt him to resume the gift which he had conferred on the Roman pontiff for the remission of his sins and the salvation of his soul. The splendid donation was granted in supreme and absolute dominion, and the world beheld for the first time a Christian bishop invested with the prerogatives of a temporal prince. The choice of magistrates, the exercise of justice, the imposition of taxes, and the wealth of the palace of Ravenna. In the dissolution of the Lombard kingdom, the inhabitants of the duchy of Spoleto sought a refuge from the storm, shaved their heads after the Roman fashion, declared themselves the servants and subjects of St. Peter, and completed by this voluntary surrender the present circle of the ecclesiastical state. That mysterious circle was enlarged to an indefinite extent by the verbal or written donation of Charlemagne, who, in the first transports of his victory, despoiled himself and the Greek emperor of the cities and islands which had formerly been annexed to the exarchate. But in the cooler moments of absence and reflection, he viewed, with an eye of jealousy and envy, the recent greatness of his ecclesiastical ally. The execution of his own and his father's promises was respectfully eluded. The king of the Franks and Lombards asserted the inalienable rights of the empire, and in his life and death, Ravenna, as well as Rome, was numbered in the list of his metropolitan cities. The sovereignty of the exarchate melted away in the hands of the popes. They found in the archbishops of Ravenna a dangerous and domestic rival. The nobles and people disdained the yoke of a priest, and in the disorders of the times they could only retain the memory of an ancient claim which, in a more prosperous age, they have revived and realized. Fraud is the resource of weakness and cunning, and the strong, though ignorant barbarian, was often entangled in the net of sacerdotal policy. The Vatican and Lateran were an arsenal and manufacture which, according to the occasion, have produced or concealed a various collection of false or genuine, of corrupt or suspicious acts, as they tended to promote the interest of the Roman Church. Before the end of the 8th century, some apostolic scribe, perhaps the notorious Isidore, composed the Decretals and the Donation of Constantine, the two magic pillars of the spiritual and temporal monarchy of the popes. This memorable donation was introduced to the world by an epistle of Adrian I, who exhorts Charlemagne to imitate the liberality and revive the name of the great Constantine. According to the legend, the first of the Christian emperors was healed of the leprosy and purified in the waters of baptism by St. Sylvester, the Roman bishop. And never was physician more gloriously recompensed. His royal proselyte withdrew from the seat and patrimony of St. Peter, declared his resolution of founding a new capital in the East, and resigned to the popes the free and perpetual sovereignty of Rome, Italy, and the provinces of the West. This fiction was productive of the most beneficial effects. The Greek princes were convicted of the guilt of usurpation, and the revolt of Gregory was the claim of his lawful inheritance. The popes were delivered from their debt of gratitude, and the nominal gifts of the Colovingians were no more than the just and irrevocable restitution of a scanty portion of the ecclesiastical state. The sovereignty of Rome no longer depended on the choice of a fickle people, and the successors of St. Peter and Constantine were invested with the purple and prerogatives of the Caesars. So deep was the ignorance and credulity of the times that the most absurd of fables was received with equal reverence in Greece and in France, and is still enrolled among the decrees of the canon law. The emperors and the Romans were incapable of discerning a forgery that subverted their rights and freedom, and the only opposition proceeded from a Sabine monastery, which in the beginning of the 12th century disputed the truth and validity of the donation of Constantine. In the revival of letters and liberty, this fictitious deed was transpierced by the pen of Laurentius Valla, the pen of an eloquent critic and a Roman patriot. His contemporaries of the 15th century were astonished at his sacrilegious boldness. Yet such is the silent and irresistible progress of reason that before the end of the next age, the fable was rejected by the contempt of historians and poets, and the tacit or modest censure of the advocates of the Roman Church. The popes themselves have indulged a smile at the credulity of the vulgar, but a false and obsolete title still sanctifies their reign. And by the same fortune which has attended the decretals and the Sibylline oracles, the edifice has subsisted after the foundations have been undermined. While the popes established in Italy their freedom and dominion, the images, the first cause of their revolt, were restored in the Eastern Empire. Under the reign of Constantine V, the union of civil and ecclesiastical power had overthrown the tree without extirpating the root of superstition. The idols, for such they were now held, were secretly cherished by the order and the sex most prone to devotion, and the fond alliance of the monks and females obtained a final victory over the reason and authority of man. Leo IV maintained with less rigor the religion of his father and grandfather, but his wife, the fair and ambitious Irene, had imbibed the zeal of the Athenians, the heirs of the idolatry, rather than the philosophy of their ancestors. During the life of her husband, these sentiments were inflamed by danger and dissimulation, and she could only labor to protect and promote some favorite monks whom she drew from their caverns and seated on the metropolitan thrones of the East. But as soon as she reigned in her own name and that of her son, Irene more seriously undertook the ruin of the iconoclasts, and the first step of her future persecution was a general edict for liberty of conscience. In the restoration of the monks, 1,000 images were exposed to the public veneration. 1,000 legends were inverted of their sufferings and miracles. By the opportunities of death or removal, the episcopal seats were judiciously filled. The most eager competitors for earthly or celestial favor anticipated and flattered the judgment of their sovereign, and the promotion of her secretary, Tiresias, gave Irene the Patriarch of Constantinople and the command of the Oriental Church. But the decrees of a general council could only be repealed by a similar assembly. The iconoclasts, whom she convened, were bold in possession and averse to debate, and the feeble voice of the bishops was re-echoed by the more formidable clamor of the soldiers and people of Constantinople. The delay and intrigues of a year, the separation of the disaffected troops, and the choice of Nice for a second Orthodox synod, removed these obstacles, and the episcopal conscience was again, after the Greek fashion, in the hands of the prince. No more than 18 days were allowed for the consummation of this important work. The iconoclasts appeared not as judges, but as criminals or penitents. The scene was decorated by the legates of Pope Adrian and the Eastern Patriarchs. The decrees were framed by the President Tiresias and ratified by the acclamations and subscriptions of 350 bishops. They unanimously pronounced that the worship of images is agreeable to Scripture and reason, to the fathers and councils of the Church. But they hesitate whether that worship be relative or direct, whether the Godhead and the figure of Christ be entitled to the same mode of adoration. Of this Second Nicene Council, the Acts are still extant. A curious monument of superstition and ignorance, of falsehood and folly. I shall only notice the judgment of the bishops on the comparative merit of image worship and morality. A monk had concluded a truce with the demon of fornication on condition of interrupting his daily prayers to a picture that hung in his cell. His scruples prompted him to consult the abbot. Rather than abstain from adoring Christ and his mother in their holy images, it would be better for you, replied the casuist, to enter every brothel and visit every prostitute in the city. For the honor of orthodoxy, at least the orthodoxy of the Roman Church, it is somewhat unfortunate that the two princes who convene the two councils of Nice are both stained with the blood of their sons. The second of these assemblies was approved and rigorously executed by the despotism of Irene, and she refused their adversaries the toleration which at first she had granted to her friends. During the 5 succeeding reigns, a period of 38 years, the contest was maintained with unabated rage and various success between the worshippers and the breakers of the images. But I am not inclined to pursue with minute diligence the repetition of the same events. Nicephorus allowed a general liberty of speech and practice, and the only virtue of his reign is accused by the monks as the cause of his temporal and eternal perdition. Superstition and weakness formed the character of Michael I, but the saints and images were incapable of supporting their votary on the throne. In the purple, Leo V asserted the name and religion of an Armenian, and the idols, with their seditious adherents, were condemned to a second exile. Their applause would have sanctified the murder of an impious tyrant, but his assassin and successor, the second Michael, was tainted from his birth with the Phrygian heresies. He attempted to mediate between the contending parties, and the intractable spirit of the Catholics insensibly cast him into the opposite scale. His moderation was guarded by timidity, but his son, Theophilus, alike ignorant of fear and pity, was the last and most cruel of the iconoclasts. The enthusiasm of the times ran strongly against them, and the emperors, who stemmed the torrent, were exasperated and punished by the public hatred. After the death of Theophilus, the final victory of the images was achieved by a second female, his widow Theodora, whom he left the guardian of the empire. Her measures were bold and decisive. The fiction of a tardy repentance absorbed the fame and the soul of her deceased husband. The sentence of the iconoclast patriarch was commuted from the loss of his eyes to a whipping of 200 lashes. The bishops trembled, the monks shouted, and the festival of orthodoxy preserves the annual memory of the triumph of the images. A single question yet remained: whether they are endowed with any proper and inherent sanctity. It was agitated by the Greeks of the 11th century, and as this opinion has the strongest recommendation of absurdity, I am surprised that it was not more explicitly decided in the affirmative. In the West, Pope Adrian I accepted and announced the decrees of the Nicene Assembly, which is now revered by the Catholics as the seventh in rank of the general councils. Rome and Italy were docile to the voice of their father, but the greatest part of the Latin Christians were far behind in the race of superstition. The churches of France, Germany, England, and Spain steered a middle course between the adoration and the destruction of images, which they admitted into their temples not as objects of worship, but as lively and useful memorials of faith and history. An angry book of controversy was composed and published in the name of Charlemagne. Under his authority, a synod of 300 bishops was assembled at Frankfurt. They blamed the fury of the iconoclasts, but they pronounced a more severe censure against the superstition of the Greeks and the decrees of their pretended council, which was long despised by the barbarians of the West. Among them, the worship of images advanced with a silent and insensible progress. But a large atonement is made for their hesitation and delay by the gross idolatry of the ages which precede the Reformation and of the countries, both in Europe and America, which are still immersed in the gloom of superstition. It was after the Nicene Synod and under the reign of the pious Irene that the popes consummated the separation of Rome and Italy by the translation of the empire to the less orthodox Charlemagne. They were compelled to choose between the rival nations. Religion was not the sole motive of their choice, and while they dissembled the failings of their friends, they beheld with reluctance and suspicion the Catholic virtues of their foes. The difference of language and manners had perpetuated the enmity of the two capitals, and they were alienated from each other by the hostile opposition of 70 years. In that schism, the Romans had tasted of freedom and the popes of sovereignty. Their submission would have exposed them to the revenge of a jealous tyrant, and the revolution of Italy had betrayed the impotence as well as the tyranny of the Byzantine court. The Greek emperors had restored the images, but they had not restored the Calabrian estates and the Illyrian diocese, which the iconoclasts had torn away from the successors of St. Peter. And Pope Adrian threatens them with a sentence of excommunication unless they speedily abjure this practical heresy. The Greeks were now orthodox, but their religion might be tainted by the breath of the reigning monarch. The Franks were now contumacious, but a discerning eye might discern their approaching conversion from the use to the adoration of images. The name of Charlemagne was stained by the polemic acrimony of his scribes, but the conqueror himself conformed with the temper of a statesman to the various practice of France and Italy. In his 4 pilgrimages or visits to the Vatican, he embraced the popes in the communion of friendship and piety, knelt before the tomb, and consequently before the image of the apostle, and joined without scruple in all the prayers and processions of the Roman liturgy. Would prudence or gratitude allow the pontiffs to renounce their benefactor? Had they a right to alienate his gift of the exarchate? Had they power to abolish his government of Rome? The title of patrician was below the merit and greatness of Charlemagne, and it was only by reviving the Western Empire that they could pay their obligations or secure their establishment. By this decisive measure, they would finally eradicate the claims of the Greeks. From the debasement of a provincial town, the majesty of Rome would be restored. The Latin Christians would be united under a supreme head in their ancient metropolis, and the conquerors of the West would receive their crown from the successors of St. Peter. The Roman Church would acquire a zealous and respectable advocate, and under the shadow of the Carlovingian power, the bishop might exercise with honor and safety the government of the city. Before the ruin of paganism in Rome, the competition for a wealthy bishopric had often been productive of tumult and bloodshed. The people was less numerous, but the times were more savage, the prize more important, and the chair of St. Peter was fiercely disputed by the leading ecclesiastics who aspired to the rank of sovereign. The reign of Adrian I surpasses the measure of past or succeeding ages. The walls of Rome, the sacred patrimony, the ruin of the Lombards, and the friendship of Charlemagne were the trophies of his fame. He secretly edified the throne of his successors and displayed in a narrow space the virtues of a great prince. His memory was revered, but in the next election a priest of the Lateran, Leo III, was preferred to the nephew and the favorite of Adrian, whom he had promoted to the first dignities of the church. Their acquiescence or repentance disguised above 4 years the blackest intention of revenge, till the day of a procession, when a furious band of conspirators dispersed the unarmed multitude and assaulted with blows and wounds the sacred person of the Pope. But their enterprise on his life or liberty was disappointed, perhaps by their own confusion and remorse. Leo was left for dead on the ground. On his revival from the swoon, the effect of his loss of blood, he recovered his speech and sight, and this natural event was improved to the miraculous restoration of his eyes and tongue, of which he had been deprived, twice deprived, by the knife of the assassins. From his prison he escaped to the Vatican. The Duke of Spoleto hastened to his rescue. Charlemagne sympathized in his injury, and in his camp of Paderborn in Westphalia accepted, or solicited, a visit from the Roman pontiff. Leo repassed the Alps with a commission of counts and bishops, the guards of his safety and the judges of his innocence, and it was not without reluctance that the conqueror of the Saxons delayed till the ensuing year the personal discharge of this pious office. In his fourth and last pilgrimage, he was received at Rome with the due honors of king and patrician. Leo was permitted to purge himself by oath of the crimes imputed to his charge. His enemies were silenced, and the sacrilegious attempt against his life was punished by the mild and insufficient penalty of exile. On the festival of Christmas, the last year of the 8th century, Charlemagne appeared in the church of St. Peter, and to gratify the vanity of Rome, he had exchanged the simple dress of his country for the habit of a patrician. After the celebration of the holy mysteries, Leo suddenly placed a precious crown on his head, and the dome resounded with the acclamations of the people. Long life and victory to Charles, the most pious Augustus, crowned by God, the great and pacific emperor of the Romans. The head and body of Charlemagne were consecrated by the royal unction. After the example of the Caesars, he was saluted or adored by the pontiff. His coronation oath represents a promise to maintain the faith and privileges of the church, and the first fruits were paid in his rich offerings to the shrine of his apostle. In his familiar conversation, the emperor protested the ignorance of the intentions of Leo, which he would have disappointed by his absence on that memorable day. But the preparations of the ceremony must have disclosed the secret, and the journey of Charlemagne revealed his knowledge and expectation. He had acknowledged that the imperial title was the object of his ambition, and a Roman synod had pronounced that it was the only adequate reward of his merit and services. The appellation of great has been often bestowed and sometimes deserved. But Charlemagne is the only prince in whose favor the title has been indissolubly blended with the name. That name, with the addition of saint, is inserted in the Roman calendar, and the saint, by rare felicity, is crowned with the praises of the historians and philosophers of an enlightened age. His real merit is doubtless enhanced by the barbarism of the nation and the times from which he emerged. But the apparent magnitude of an object is likewise enlarged by an unequal comparison, and the ruins of Palmyra derive a casual splendor from the nakedness of the surrounding desert. Without injustice to his fame, I may discern some blemishes in the sanctity and greatness of the restorer of the Western Empire. Of his moral virtues, chastity is not the most conspicuous, but the public happiness could not be materially injured by his 9 wives or concubines, the various indulgence of meaner or more transient amours, the multitude of his bastards whom he bestowed on the church, and the long celibacy and licentious manners of his daughters, whom the father was suspected of loving with too fond a passion. I shall be scarcely permitted to accuse the ambition of a conqueror, but in a day of equal retribution, the sons of his brother Carloman, the Merovingian princes of Aquitaine, and the 4,500 Saxons who were beheaded on the same spot, would have something to allege against the justice and humanity of Charlemagne. His treatment of the vanquished Saxons was an abuse of the right of conquest. His laws were not less sanguinary than his arms, and in the discussion of his motives, whatever is subtracted from bigotry must be imputed to temper. The sedentary reader is amazed by his incessant activity of mind and body, and his subjects and enemies were not less astonished at his sudden presence at the moment when they believed him at the most distant extremity of the empire. Neither peace nor war, nor summer nor winter, were a season of repose, and our fancy cannot easily reconcile the annals of his reign with the geography of his expeditions. But this activity was a national rather than a personal virtue. The vagrant life of a Frank was spent in the chase, in pilgrimage, in military adventures, and the journeys of Charlemagne were distinguished only by a more numerous train and a more important purpose. His military renown must be tried by the scrutiny of his troops, his enemies, and his actions. Alexander conquered with the arms of Philip, but the two heroes who preceded Charlemagne bequeathed him their name, their examples, and the companions of their victories. At the head of his veteran and superior armies, he oppressed the savage or degenerate nations who were incapable of confederating for their common safety. Nor did he ever encounter an equal antagonist in numbers, in discipline, or in arms. The science of war has been lost and revived with the arts of peace, but his campaigns are not illustrated by any siege or battle of singular difficulty and success, and he might behold with envy the Saracen trophies of his grandfather. After the Spanish expedition, his rearguard was defeated in the Pyrenean Mountains, and the soldiers, whose situation was irretrievable and whose valor was useless, might accuse with their last breath the want of skill or caution of their general. I touch with reverence the laws of Charlemagne, so highly applauded by a respectable judge. They compose not a system, but a series of occasional and minute edicts for the correction of abuses, the reformation of manners, the economy of his farms, the care of his poultry, and even the sale of his eggs. He wished to improve the laws and the character of the Franks, and his attempts, however feeble and imperfect, are deserving of praise. The inveterate evils of the times were suspended or mollified by his government. But in his institutions I can seldom discover the general views and the immortal spirit of a legislator who survives himself for the benefit of posterity. The unity and stability of his empire depended on the life of a single man. He imitated the dangerous practice of dividing his kingdoms among his sons, and after his numerous diets, the whole constitution was left to fluctuate between the disorders of anarchy and despotism. His esteem for the piety and knowledge of the clergy tempted him to entrust that aspiring order with temporal dominion and civil jurisdiction. And his son Louis, when he was stripped and degraded by the bishops, might accuse in some measure the imprudence of his father. His laws enforced the imposition of tithes, because the demons had proclaimed in the air that the default of payment had been the cause of the last scarcity. The literary merits of Charlemagne are attested by the foundation of schools, the introduction of arts, the works which were published in his name, and his familiar connection with the subjects and strangers whom he invited to his court to educate both the prince and people. His own studies were tardy, laborious, and imperfect. If he spoke Latin and understood Greek, he derived the rudiments of knowledge from conversation rather than from books. And in his mature age, the emperor strove to acquire the practice of writing, which every peasant now learns in his infancy. The grammar and logic, the music and astronomy of the times were only cultivated as the handmaids of superstition. But the curiosity of the human mind must ultimately tend to its improvement, and the encouragement of learning reflects the purest and most pleasing luster on the character of Charlemagne. The dignity of his person, the length of his reign, the prosperity of his arms, the vigor of his government, and the reverence of distant nations distinguish him from the royal crowd, and Europe dates a new era from his restoration of the Western Empire. That empire was not unworthy of its title, and some of the fairest kingdoms of Europe were the patrimony or conquest of a prince who reigned at the same time in France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Hungary. The Roman province of Gaul had been transformed into the name and monarchy of France, but in the decay of the Merovingian line, its limits were contracted by the independence of the Britons and the revolt of Aquitaine. Charlemagne pursued and confined the Britons on the shores of the ocean, and that ferocious tribe, whose origin and language are so different from the French, was chastised by the imposition of tribute, hostages, and peace. After a long and evasive contest, the rebellion of the Dukes of Aquitaine was punished by the forfeiture of their province, their liberty, and their lives. Harsh and rigorous would have been such treatment of ambitious governors who had too faithfully copied the mayors of the palace. But a recent discovery has proved that these unhappy princes were the last and lawful heirs of the blood and scepter of Clovis, and younger branch from the brother of Dagobert of the Merovingian house. Their ancient kingdom was reduced to the Duchy of Gascon, to the counties of Fezensac and Armagnac, at the foot of the Pyrenees. Their race was propagated till the beginning of the 16th century, and after surviving their Carlovingian tyrants, they were reserved to feel the injustice or the favors of a third dynasty. By the reunion of Aquitaine, France was enlarged to its present boundaries, with the additions of the Netherlands and Spain as far as the Rhine. The Saracens had been expelled from France by the grandfather and father of Charlemagne, but they still possessed the greatest part of Spain, from the Rock of Gibraltar to the Pyrenees. Amidst their civil divisions, an Arabian emir of Saragossa implored his protection in the Diet of Paderborn. Charlemagne undertook the expedition, restored the emir, and without distinction of faith, impartially crushed the resistance of the Christians and rewarded the obedience and services of the Muslims. In his absence, he instituted the Spanish March, which extended from the Pyrenees to the River Ebro. Barcelona was the residence of the French governor. He possessed the counties of Roussillon and Catalonia, and the infant kingdoms of Navarre and Aragon were subject to his jurisdiction. As king of the Lombards and patrician of Rome, he reigned over the greatest part of Italy, a tract of 1,000 miles from the Alps to the borders of Calabria. The Duchy of Beneventum, a Lombard fief, had spread at the expense of the Greeks over the modern kingdom of Naples. But Arechis, the reigning duke, refused to be included in the slavery of his country, assumed the independent title of prince, and opposed his sword to the Carlovingian monarchy. His defense was firm, his submission was not inglorious, and the emperor was content with an easy tribute, the demolition of his fortresses, and the acknowledgement, on his coins, of a supreme lord. The artful flattery of his son Grimoald added the appellation of father, but he asserted his dignity with prudence, and Beneventum insensibly escaped from the French yoke. Charlemagne was the first who united Germany under the same scepter. The name of Oriental France is preserved in the circle of Franconia, and the people of Hesse and Thuringia were recently incorporated with the victors by the conformity of religion and government. The Alemanni, so formidable to the Romans, were the faithful vassals and confederates of the Franks, and their country was inscribed within the modern limits of Alsace, Swabia, and Switzerland. The Bavarians, with a similar indulgence of their laws and manners, were less patient of a master. The repeated treasons of Tassilo justified the abolition of their hereditary dukes, and their power was shared among the counts, who judged and guarded that important frontier. But the north of Germany, from the Rhine and beyond the Elbe, was still hostile and pagan. Nor was it till after a war of 33 years that the Saxons bowed under the yoke of Christ and of Charlemagne. The idols and their votaries were extirpated. The foundation of 8 bishoprics, of Munster, Osnaburg, Paderborn, and Minden, of Bremen, Verden, Hildesheim, and Halberstadt, define, on either side of the Weser, the bounds of ancient Saxony. These episcopal seats were the first schools and cities of that savage land, and the religion and humanity of the children atoned, in some degree, for the massacre of the parents. Beyond the Elbe, the Slavi, or Sclavonians, of similar manners and various denominations, overspread the modern dominions of Prussia, Poland, and Bohemia, and some transient marks of obedience have tempted the French historian to extend the empire to the Baltic and the Vistula. The conquest or conversion of those countries is of a more recent age, but the first union of Bohemia with the Germanic body may be justly ascribed to the arms of Charlemagne. He retaliated on the Avars or Huns of Pannonia the same calamities which they had inflicted on the nations. Their rings, the wooden fortifications which encircled their districts and villages, were broken down by the triple effort of a French army that was poured into their country by land and water, through the Carpathian Mountains and along the plain of the Danube. After a bloody conflict of 8 years, the loss of some French generals was avenged by the slaughter of the most noble Huns. The relics of the nation submitted. The royal residence of the Chagan was left desolate and unknown. And the treasures, the rapine of 250 years, enriched the victorious troops or decorated the churches of Italy and Gaul. After the reduction of Pannonia, the empire of Charlemagne was bounded only by the conflux of the Danube with the Theiss and the Save. The provinces of Istria, Liburnia, and Dalmatia were an easy, though unprofitable, accession, and it was an effect of his moderation that he left the maritime cities under the real or nominal sovereignty of the Greeks. But these distant possessions added more to the reputation than to the power of the Latin emperor, nor did he risk any ecclesiastical foundations to reclaim the barbarians from their vagrant life and idolatrous worship. Some canals of communication between the rivers, the Saone and the Meuse, the Rhine and the Danube, were